to me.
What?
This. I indicated the mint tea. How on earth anyone can drink hot tea in weather like this?
You can get used to anything eventually, she surmised. It all starts to seem normal after a while.
Not to me, I said, rubbing at my fingertips, angry that I had held onto the glass for a moment too long so that the hot surface had burned my skin, angrier still that Lucy had not rushed to agree with me with my inane complaint. Not this. I don't think I'll ever be able to drink this in such hot weather. I don't think I'll ever want to drink it in any weather, to be honest. She took a sip from her own tall glass.
Don't you enjoy it?
I shot her a look then. Hysterical, I thought, though I quickly swept it away.
I would quite literally murder someone for a cup of builder's tea at this point, I told her.
A few heads turned our way, and I realized that my tone was wavering somewhere between light-hearted and serious, skirting the liminal boundaries between laughing and crying. Lucy extended her hand to me, but I did not take it.
Are you all right? She asked again.
I considered, tired already of the question, of what I suspected was the truth.
In New England, Lucy began abruptly. My father had the most ingenious way of keeping us all cool during the heat waves.
And what was that? I asked, the question curt, irritated by this shift, this change in conversation. But if Lucy noticed, she only carried on, and I wondered then if it was because she could sense my flaring temper that she had introduced the topic, an attempt at distraction.
He used to bring out the garden hose. You have those in England, don't you?
I nodded, but remained silent.
Well, he used to take the hose and then walk around the house watering the bricks.
I frowned. The bricks?
Yes, the bricks of the house.
Why on earth would he do that? I questioned. She smiled.
That's where all the heat is. The bricks trap it all in. So, very carefully, my father would circle the house, spraying the water onto every inch until the bricks steamed from the combination of hot and cold.
She stopped, and in her silence I imagined it, conjuring up the image of a tiny brick house, a father who cared for his daughter enough that he lingered on the bricks surrounding her bedroom window, making sure they were properly glistening before moving on.
Did it really help?
I asked, my voice softer than it had been. I looked at Lucy and I wondered what she was thinking, if she was also imagining that small house in the middle of nowhere New England, or if she was thinking of somewhere else altogether.
It did, Lucy said, in a tone that I suspected was meant to assure me, to calm me. I remember lying on my bed listening to the water as it sprayed against my bedroom wall, and I could feel it. As I lay there, my eyes closed, the curtains drawn to keep out the sun, so the room was entirely lost in darkness. I could feel the moment the water hit, the instant relief it provided, as if someone had turned on a fan and placed it directly in front of me. Sometimes I would get goosebumps, it was so cold.
I was quiet for a moment, thinking, imagining the cool breeze on my skin. I felt strangely calm, surrounded by the love of a father for his daughter, by the cool draft he had sweated and worked to provide for her. Something tugged at my memory. I remembered that day in Jennings Hall all those years ago, and turning to Lucy, I lowered my sunglasses and said, "I thought you didn't remember your father." A moment passed by, and another still, so that I wondered if she would ignore my words altogether. And then, she did not turn to me, did not take off her own sunglasses. Instead, she remained facing the ocean, her face as sturdy as the stone we had just stood upon.
"I remember that," she said, her tone a warning, a threat.
I turned away from her and remained silent. It had been snowing heavily that night. Of course, it was the Green Mountains, and in the heart of winter it seemed like it was always either snowing or threatening to snow, a blanket of ghostly white providing a permanent coat on the ground. But that night had been different,
The snow stuck not only to the pavement, but also to the lights, to one's own person, so that everything passed by in a swirl as you fought and struggled to make your way through it. Lucy and I had been fighting. I had returned earlier in the day, before the snow began, from a trip to New York. I had told everyone that it was an assignment for my photography class, but really it had been a chance for escape, a respite from the suffocating unease that had steadily crept between Lucy and me over the last year, so that it was suddenly all that existed between us. My aunt had not even been in town that weekend. I had arranged to stay at a boarding house in the city, one that I had passed numerous times and had deemed safe enough. I had thought for a moment of inviting Tom to join me, to make it a mini break rather than an escape. But in the end, I knew what I needed most was to be alone, from both of them, from the constant back and forth that I had begun to experience each and every day, as if I could actually feel it, my bones, my skin being pulled between them, taut and threatening to break. In New York, unlike Vermont, the air was neither clean nor crisp. Instead, it was heavy, laden with dust and grease and smoke. It seemed to hang, damp and thick, clinging to my skin. Stepping off the bus and into the city, I had smiled in relief. I spent the next 2 days roaming the streets, taking pictures. I finished all the rolls of film I had brought with me, and ended up stopping into a camera shop to buy half a dozen more. Those I finished too. There was something relaxing about being alone, finally alone, among a sea of people that I did not know, and who did not know me. I lost myself in the facelessness of it all, thrilled to find myself surrounded by strangers. I sat on park benches, listening to the conversations that took place around me. I explored the stainless steel diners of the city, sitting at counters, eating grilled cheese and sipping burned coffee, enjoying the weighty feel of the porcelain mug in my hand. And while rations were now a thing of the past, the notices still hung, fading and colored with grease. Do not ask for butter today. No hamburgers, it's Tuesday. An enduring reminder. Returning back to campus Sunday evening, I went straight to the darkroom to begin developing, not yet ready to shed the feeling of calm, of peace, that I had managed to summon amid the chaos of the city. I hummed quietly to myself as I removed the film in the darkened room, my hands moving with quick, memorized movements as I wound it around the spool, feeling for that little groove where the film would catch. I placed each one, gingerly, inside the canister, and once developed, hung them carefully on the line. Almost an hour later, the chemicals returned to the correct shelves, the negatives dry. I made a contact sheet of each, eager to see whether I had managed to capture anything worthwhile during my short stay. It was then that I noticed her. At first I thought it was only my imagination or a trick of the light. Perhaps my eyes were simply tired. I told myself that there was any number of explanations for what I was seeing, that it was not real, that the evidence of her, the back of her coat, the profile of her face, could not in fact belong to her. But then I found it, the one photograph where she hadn't managed to step completely out of the way, where not only a glimpse of her could be seen, but also the entirety of her face. It was her. It was Lucy. And she was there, following me, stalking me, present in each and every frame I had taken in New York. It was easy to miss if I hadn't been familiar with her long, tangled hair, if I hadn't seen her peacoat draped over the chair in our room day after day. Perhaps then I wouldn't have noticed it. She was only in the background, after all, only in the corner of the photograph. She was never the focus, never in the forefront. But then there was the one where she had not managed to avoid my lens, where her face stared up at me, her eyes large and unblinking, watching me, always watching. I clasped the photograph in my hand, which was now trembling, and left the darkroom, not bothering to clean up, not bothering to switch off the lights, but walking out into the dark, out into the snow, the steady throb of it making even the short walk between the darkroom and our house nearly impossible. I kept the photograph, the evidence, hidden inside my coat, an effort to keep it protected from the elements, so that when I produced it, when I placed it in front of her at last, there would only be a streak here or there where it had been distorted by the snow. She had been sitting at her desk, head bent over a book, and made no move to rise at my abrupt entrance. She was silent for a moment, looking down at the photograph, a strange stillness to her movements as she raised her eyes and asked,
"What is this?"
Her face closed and unreadable. "Look," I said, my hand shaking as I pushed the photograph closer to her. When I was met with the same stony silence, I thrust my finger toward the figure displayed before us. "I know it's you, Lucy," I said, doing my best to make my voice hard. "The photograph may be a bit grainy, but I know it's you." She did not speak, and in the absence of words my eyes travelled to the photograph. I was struck, then, by just how grainy the photograph actually was. I scanned it again. Everything was just as I remembered, but it was as if the focus was off, just a tiny amount, so that the distinct lines of each face, her face in particular, were blurry rather than sharp. Shadows. She frowned, standing now.
"You saw me in New York?"
"No, that wasn't what I had meant." I shook my head. "No, in the picture," I said, fumbling for words. "You were there. I know you were."
"Alice, I've been here the entire weekend."
Her hands were on my shoulders, her fingers pressing into my skin. It was meant as a gesture of comfort, of concern, I knew, but instead I felt as though her fingertips were burning into my flesh. I had to get out. My heart had begun to beat, fast and unsteady. My throat felt as though it were closing up, and each breath was a struggle, a strain. I felt my skin begin to flush, and I wrenched myself free, desperate to put space between us, to remove myself from her touch.
"You're lying,"
I said, heading toward the door, the words strangled in my throat. In the hallway, I found the payphone and called Tom. Afterward, I struggled to recall what it was that I had told him, my voice low and urgent, words tumbling from my mouth before I could consider them. But I remembered always what he had said in return, that he would come, that it didn't matter about the blizzard, that he would come and get me, that he wouldn't leave me alone, he promised. I headed outside into the freezing cold, the snow falling to the ground at a faster rate than I had seen in all my years in the Green Mountains, and Lucy followed, at first placating, then arguing, and then begging, for me to stay, for me to forget the photograph. I did not relent, only stood, waiting until Tom eventually arrived, his face distorted from the melting ice on the car. I had turned to go then, when a hand, hard and unyielding, forced me to pause.
"Don't get in the car, Alice."
"Let me go, Lucy,"
I commanded, wrenching free of her grasp.
"Alice,"
she said, her voice desperate now, I thought.
"You can't just go."
I spun around.
"Why not?"
I didn't need a response. I could have simply got in the car and left. But I wanted to know, in that instance, what she would say, what words she would find to extract herself from this as well. She was silent, and I shook my head.
"I want you to leave me alone,"
I shouted then, the wind burning my cheeks, stealing my words.
"I want you to disappear and never come back."
Then I turned and got into the car. Tom was quiet as we drove away, perhaps sensing that I did not want to speak, that I did not want to discuss what had happened. I thought instead about where we would go. Town, perhaps, to our favorite little diner on US Route 7. We would sit and drink good strong coffee, and it would steady my hands, which now trembled in my lap. I shook my head, trying to dislodge whatever was left of Lucy there. No more, I promised myself. Instead, I would concentrate on the future, on Tom. And once we reached that diner, perhaps I would finally tell him what I had once told Lucy, about the months after my parents' death, the shadows, the asylum. And then, even those things I had not. I would tell him, I had decided, about the real reason for the bouts of anxiety, about the accident that had killed my parents, and how I worried still, even then, that I was the one to blame. After all, I had been the last one to use that wretched paraffin heater. I could still picture it in my mind, the little black contraption my father had brought home one day. He had been so proud, showing me how to carefully lift the lid in order to fill it with the paraffin, and from there how to press the wick into the liquid on one end and light it on the other. It would keep us warm during the winter, he had promised. And what was better, it would save money, since the heater was portable and could be picked up and carried from room to room. But you must always be careful, he had warned me. The paraffin is highly inflammable. I still remembered my childish response.
Inflammable? Does that mean it won't catch fire?
He had laughed at that, at his silly little Alice in Wonderland. He had pulled me into a tight embrace, the last I could ever remember receiving from him. That was what I had been thinking about, the ghosts of my past that I could never quite manage to dispel, along with the simple nagging question. Had it been my fault? Had I been the last one to use the heater that claimed my parents' lives? When it happened, we had reached the top of the hill and begun the descent down the drive on the long, twisting road that would lead us out of the college's property and into the town, when Tom turned to me, panic flooding his eyes, and said,
"They aren't working."
"What aren't working?" I asked, my voice lazy as I peered out of the car and into the darkness. It wasn't yet 6 o'clock, but already the winter darkness had fallen, making it nearly impossible to see anything within a few feet without a light. I lifted my hand in front of me, wondering whether I would be able to make out all of its features. I exhaled, watching my breath emerge in a tiny cloud before dissipating into the air.
"The brakes!"
I dropped my hand. I took in Tom's stricken face, which I could still make out, even in the darkness. That was what struck me first, in that strange little moment. But then I heard his foot pumping away at the useless pedal, and something inside me stilled.
"What do you mean?"
I whispered.
"I mean they won't work,"
he said, his voice rising in panic. The car had nearly reached the end of the drive by then, that point at which the private pathway of Bennington's Road connected with the public one. In front of us I watched as one car passed by and then another, each one half hidden, it seemed, by the darkness. I closed my eyes, held my breath, but I knew that even if we somehow managed not to crash into another car, there was still the problem of the road, which stretched immediately to the left and right, but not directly ahead. Instead, there was a flimsy barricade, and beyond that, I swallowed nervously, our self-christened end of the universe. My gaze quickly took in the sugar maples beyond the railing, standing in sinister formation. I turned then, twisting around, peering back at the darkness behind us, knowing that I would not be able to see anything, that I would not be able to see her, even though I could feel her still, watching. I thought of her words, of her insistence that I not get into the automobile, and I felt my stomach lurch, though whether from the movement of the car or the realization of something greater, something darker, I was never entirely certain. And then Tom shouted, telling me to jump, so that my shaking hands reached for the cold handle. There was nothing then, only the strange sensation of my body being lifted into the air, weightless and suspended. Afterward there was blood and fire, broken bones and bruises. But I did not feel any of it. Only the snow underneath my face, the cold, biting pain of it against my cheek. And Lucy, somewhere in the distance, looking at me, her eyes wide, watching, alive. It was the last thing that I remembered from that night. Aunt Maud arrived in the days afterward. I was never sure how many had passed before she swept in, her stern, frowning face serving as a source of comfort, a return to normalcy in the swirling chaos that had surrounded me ever since I had woken. I had scarcely been left alone during that time, so it seemed there was always someone beside me, in the room, outside the room, peering in. And yet not one of them ever spoke to me, with me, only around me, at me, instructions and directions, orders but no information, nothing that told me what had happened, how it had happened, and perhaps most importantly, why.
Maud,
I whispered, my lips parched and cracked. She moved quickly beside me, though she did not take my hand.
Quiet, dear, she said.
I closed my eyes at the sound of her voice, at her familiar accent, so similar to my own. Her face, though decidedly feminine, still held something of my father, her brother, in it as well, such that I felt her reassurance wash over me, blanket me. My body sagged, and for the first time in days I felt the adrenaline begin to seep from my pores, so that all at once I felt comforted, and I felt pain, the bruises and cuts I had ignored, that I had refused to feel, creeping upon me so that they could no longer be denied. I felt wetness against my cheeks, and realized that I had begun to cry.
Lucy,
I whispered.
Where is Lucy?
But I was uncertain whether she could understand my words, distorted as they were by my increasing sobs.
You have to speak with her, to ask her about what happened.
There, there, Maud whispered, lowering herself into the seat behind me.
She still did not move to touch me, though in that moment I wished that she would.
You're overwrought, Alice, confused. But everything will be all right, my dear. I will take care of it. You have my word.
A week later I was out of the hospital and on my way back to England. No one spoke of Tom, of his funeral, of an invitation I knew would not come. Only once was Lucy mentioned, when the police, bullied and cowed by Maud, were permitted to ask a few questions under her direct supervision. My answers were short, clipped. They raised their eyebrows when I asked about Lucy Mason, about whether they had spoken to her, but then a sharp look from Maud silenced any further questions.
"She's confused, officers. You must excuse her."
She turned to me and smiled.
"You're confused, Alice, dear."
At first I had frowned at her words, but soon I had begun to wonder whether perhaps she was right. That night already seemed distant, the details lost to me, so the only thing remaining was the conviction that Lucy was somehow the key to it all, the answer to the question that I could not quite figure out. I searched my memory but could find nothing more definitive than the injured feelings of a girl that had been abandoned by her best friend, or the look she had given me that night as I had walked away, had crawled into the car, definitively choosing another over her, severing whatever bond it was that had connected us. I pushed the image from my mind. Perhaps Maud was right.
"You're confused, Alice," she whispered again, the crinkles around her eyes deepening. "Your grief is causing you to imagine things, but you must not allow it to... You must put them out of your mind."
She attempted a smile.
"Do not worry, my dear. I will take care of everything."
I had nodded dully, still lost in a cocoon of my own grief. If Aunt Maud said that Lucy did not hold the answers, then I would trust her, completely. I thought back to when my parents had died, how lost in grief I had been, how the shadows had stolen across my vision, and I had howled for her to make them go away. And she had. She had fixed me, just as she promised. If not completely, at least the best she could, gluing and taping back the pieces of me that had fallen apart in the aftermath of my parents' death. And so now I would trust her again, to put me back together, just like the old nursery rhyme, to make things right. I found comfort in the thought, in the ability to let it go, my anger, my hatred, my conviction. There was a peace in letting it slip between my fingers, no longer a mass that I was forced to grasp, to cling to with all my might. After all, Tom was gone. Nothing else mattered. Not Lucy, not what had happened to her in those days afterward, her side of the room empty and still, not even the strange words that my aunt had spoken. And so I did not ask her what they meant. In the quiet I could feel it again. The anger, just like that night, beginning to grow. I was tired of the elusive answers, of the bits of information that Lucy fed me only when it suited her. I still did not know why she was in Tangier, not really, or how long she planned to stay. I did not even know how she spent her days, only the stories she told me each night. I could feel my face start to flush, feel my hands start to tremble. I willed myself to remain calm, to instead focus on my mint tea, which had grown cold and thick. But I found I couldn't concentrate. I was tired of the pretense, and I could not continue, even if she could. I felt my emotions begin to well, begin to creep inside, to the hollow of my bones, the accusations sitting on the edge of my tongue. The truth was that nothing had felt right since the night of the accident, and between us, between Lucy and me, things had started to sour long before then, so that the time since we had been close was so long ago now that I struggled to remember. There were moments when I would catch pieces of it, glimmering in the distance, when I could feel that same pull toward her, strong and insistent. But then there was something else there as well, something hard and unyielding, so that I still did not entirely trust her, felt that I could never trust her after everything that had happened, not even if I had wanted to. I knew, of course, that she was not responsible for what happened, not in the sense that I had first suspected, that dark, cold night when I had turned around in the car, eyes blazing, certain she was the one. In my mind I made her into something profane, something monstrous, one of my shadows that lurked in the darkness, waiting, always waiting, to lay hold of me. The truth was much more simple. The truth was that had it not been for her, I would not have made that telephone call, would not have crawled inside his automobile the night of the blizzard. If it had not been for her jealousy, her strangeness, it would never have happened. That was the truth, or at least part of it. It was the real reason why I had stopped and stuttered at her presence the morning she had arrived in Tangier. For in her, I would always be reminded of him, of what had happened, of what she had made happen. But there was something more, too. I turned to her now, lowering my black sunglasses once more, so that my eyes peered out at her, wide and unflinching. I opened my mouth to tell her, to accuse her, finally. But instead, what I said was, "You left." I had meant the words as a question, but they fell, heavy and dull, and I wondered then whether that wasn't the real reason why I had spent so long blaming her, for abandoning me when I needed her most. "After the accident, after Tom," I said, giving voice to what I had long since puzzled over, of what I had read as evidence of her guilt, of her admittance. "You left." She looked up at me, squinting. "You told me to, Alice." Her words were simple but true. I had told her to go that night, had told her other things that I could no longer remember but that I felt in the pit of my stomach on those rare occasions when I let the memories find their way in. I had wished for awful things in those moments, and they had come true. Only it hadn't been to her that they had happened. They had happened to me, to Tom. And it was my fault, not hers, that they had. It began to slip away then, the wall that I had placed between us since her arrival, since that night of the blizzard. I felt it give way in that moment, the resistance that I had worked so hard to cultivate, its mass no longer something that was tangible, solid, so that my fingers grasped, unable to hold on to it any longer. "I haven't felt like myself since we arrived, not really," I said then, pausing a moment, letting the confession settle between us. "It all feels too much sometimes, don't you think? Sometimes I feel as though I can't breathe. I'm filled with so much dread at the thought of walking out my front door on my own. I know it's ridiculous, but I can't help it. I just don't feel myself here." I stopped, staring into space, my breath heavy and ragged. "I know it's all down to me, isn't it? I chose to come here." A laugh escaped from me. "Although what other choice did I have, really?" Lucy waited the space of a few moments before speaking. "Is it really as bad as all that, Alice?" I wanted to flinch then, under the intensity of her gaze. But I didn't. I could see from her face, could tell from the sound of her voice, that she didn't understand, that she couldn't. I thought of what she had said earlier about the different names that Tangier had had over the course of history. In some ways I felt like it was appropriate to the moment. We were both of us in the same place, but in two very different versions of Tangier. And I could not imagine hers, a place of excitement, a place to start anew. Mine held only fear and isolation. "Of course not," I murmured, my voice barely above a whisper. But then, because I could not stop, not when the words were finally pouring from me, I asked, "Do you ever regret going to Bennington?" Lucy frowned, startled, it seemed, by my words.
"Regret it?"
My voice wavered as I spoke.
"Yes, sometimes I feel like I do. Regret it, I mean, almost horribly so. I feel like they lied to us in a way, making us feel like we could go off into the world and be equal to them, to men, I mean. But it's all lies, isn't it? They lied to us. We thought we were learning a vocation, but really they're just a finishing school in disguise, preparing us with hobbies to pass the time once we marry. It makes it all so much more difficult."
"But Alice," Lucy began, "it doesn't have to be like that." A laugh escaped me, one that sounded more akin to a sob than anything else. I rushed to cover it.
"Don't mind me, Lucy. It's the heat, I think. I never was very good with it. There's something about a hot, sunny day that puts my teeth on edge. I always feel as though I'm teetering on the precipice of something."
I paused.
"It will pass."
But in that moment I knew that I didn't want it to pass. I wanted, oh, I didn't know what, for her to take my hand like she had in the old days, to tell me that if I wanted to get away from Tangier, she would be that for me, my way out. The words swelled on my lips. Everything, the whole mess, how distant John had grown over the months, how I had become convinced that I had made the wrong decision when I had agreed to marry him, to come to this wretched place. I longed to speak then, to confide, to tell Lucy everything, but the words would not come. I stood, fumbling in my purse for francs, looking around for the boy who had served us our tea, anxious to leave, though to go where, I didn't know. I felt stuck, trapped, and the realization that there was no way out, no place that I could escape to, threatened to overwhelm me. In response, Lucy stood, placing a few coins on the table, her movements anticipating my own once more, I noted. We were halfway up the aisle of the terraced settings when I felt Lucy's body press against my own, when I heard a crash sound directly below. I jumped, startled by the noise, but certain, in that moment, that it had been one of the waiters, perhaps the boy who had served us our tea, having dropped one of those swinging contraptions from his hands. But then I glanced backward and saw her, a woman, vaguely familiar, though I couldn't quite manage to place her, lying at the bottom of the stairs, the broken glass surrounding her an intricate mosaic that shimmered underneath the afternoon sun. My hand flew to my mouth, aghast.
"Lucy?"
I heard myself whisper. The cafe erupted in pandemonium then. The waiters rushed down to assist the woman, who was, I saw with a relieved sigh, sitting up slowly. Customers rose from their seats, a few even leaving their belongings unattended as they rushed to offer aid. I could see that the woman's arms and legs had been badly scraped up. By the fall, by the glass, I didn't know. She stood, testing her ankle, as though hesitant to place any weight on it. And then she looked up, to where Lucy and I stood, her eyes dark and shining. I felt my stomach turn, felt the taste of the mint from the tea go sour in my mouth. Something like fear ran through me then, so that I reached out my hand, clamping onto Lucy's wrist.
"Can we go?"
I asked, my voice broken, shattered. My fingers, I knew, were digging into her skin, but I could not stop, could not pause the strange rising tide of panic. For in that moment, Despite everything, despite all my uneasiness and suspicions, and everything that had occurred between us over the years, I was certain of the one thing I had always known about Lucy. That she loved me. That she would do anything to help me. And so I turned to her now, my voice pleading, and said,
"Oh, please, Lucy, can't we go?"
I wasn't sure exactly what I meant by those words. I knew only that I had to get away. From the cafe, from the woman's insistent gaze, from the truth of my relationship with John. I could not look at it, could not take it out into the sun and examine it, not just yet. In that moment, I only wanted to be away from it, from him, from Tangier. Part 2.
Chapter 8. Lucy. We should go to Chef Schoen. I made the pronouncement over breakfast as Alice and I sat silently over our tea and bread, voicing the words before thinking them through, before worrying about whether her answer would be yes or no. I knew only that after the incident at Café Haffa, I was desperate for more traces of Alice, of the original, ancient Alice, that had once spent late nights with me in the local diner, laughing over coffee and maple syrup pancakes, the one I had sat next to during winter, watching as the fire rose and fell before us. I realized now that Morocco threatened to burn those memories away, burn the both of us to ash. We needed a break from the heat, from the city, from Tangier. "We could hire a grand taxi to drive us," I explained. "It's not that expensive and it's fairly easy. I could go now and find one and be back in no time at all. You wouldn't have to do a thing but pack a bag. And it's supposed to be beautiful, Alice." I spoke hastily, as if a torrent of words would be enough to protect me from her protestations, her probable refusal. Alice nodded, her teacup held tightly between her two hands, her knuckles white. "All right, then." The words slipped out quickly, as if she needed to expunge them from her body before she had time to consider, to reconsider. "All right, Lucy, let's go." She smiled, and in it I could see a glimmer of hope, a glimmer of her. I knew that it was time then, to tell her what I had seen, first at the bar and later in the streets of Tangier, that now was the time to relay all my hopes and dreams for the future, for us, so that the two of us could move forward together just like we had always planned. But first, we needed to get away. From John, from Tangier, where the past remained steadfastly behind, and the present could no longer touch us. We arrived 3 hours later. The ride was only supposed to take two, but Alice had pleaded for the driver to pull the taxi over so that she could hop out and take photographs of the scenery, of the Rif women, of the rolling green mountains that looked entirely out of place in Morocco. At first, the driver had not understood. The poor man had, in fact, looked fairly frightened when Alice had begun exclaiming wildly for him to stop, and then, failing to make her point with words, began vigorously tapping him on the shoulder. It was the first time I had seen her produce the camera that had once belonged to her mother. The casing surrounding the lens had been chipped. "My mother's fault," Alice had once insisted, and there was a jagged line that appeared in the lens when you looked through it, though for some reason it did not appear on any of the printed photographs. Alice had explained it once, but I had forgotten. The world of photography and science in general made little sense to me. It was full of numbers and absolutes, something I had never been very good at. But I had always loved to watch her work, watching from the doorway as she poured and measured the required chemicals, stirring and shaking until they were just right, until the negatives had become something real and tangible, and she at last pinned up her contact sheets to the rack. I had wondered over those first few days in Tangier if she had left the camera behind in England, along with the other traces of her former life that she had seemed to relinquish. Once, while she was in the bath, I had even gone looking for it, though a search of her room had produced nothing but dresses I did not recognize, tiny perfume bottles that did not smell quite as I remembered her, and a strange emptiness that seemed to pervade the room, as if it were not quite real, as if it were all for show. I cast a glance out the back window of the car, watching the trail of dust that we left in our wake, watching as Tangier disappeared behind us, imagining that I could already feel the change, the difference, its hold, its grip, suddenly less. The camera, I thought, was proof. In Chef Shawin, we moved slowly through the Medina.
Can you believe how blue it is?
Alice murmured, repeating the words over and over again, until it seemed that she was no longer speaking them expecting a response, but as if they were an incantation necessary to reassure herself that it was real. At times she disappeared from my sight, but I was able to locate her by the clatter of metal as it echoed against the silent walls. I could turn the corner, I knew, and she would be there. So I slowed my pace, allowing her to run off as she pleased, knowing that I would be able to find her when needed. There was a calm to the city that was immediately at odds with Tangier. No one rushed to sell us anything. No one beckoned from restaurants or cafes. There was an eerie quiet after all the noise and bustle of Tangier. I wasn't sure I entirely enjoyed it. I had always been made for cities. For the dark and dingy alleyways, for the 24-hour cacophony of noise, for the overbearing and often cloying smells, and the tightly packed familiarity of strangers. Chef Shawin was the opposite. It was light, where Tangier was dark. It was airy, where Tangier was stifling. It was soothing, where Tangier refused to let anyone within its grasp exhale or take a breath. I did not belong here. I felt it instinctively, but I could see that Alice did. This place was made for her, and for that reason, I decided it was perfect. We continued on like this, an ebb and flow, I thought, for nearly an hour, at the end of which Alice turned to me. Her arms hung limply by her side.
"I'm exhausted, Lucy,"
she sighed,
"and in desperate need of a cup of tea."
"It's likely to be mint," I warned her with a hesitant smile, wondering if it was yet still too soon to laugh about yesterday, her anxiety, her frustration boiling under the Tangier sun. She took a deep breath, her lungs exhaling for what seemed like the first time.
"I don't care,"
she said, looking around us, the smile on her face deepening.
"Tonight, I don't care about any of it."
After that, we hurried to find a place in the Medina to spend the night. "Look there, a bed and breakfast," I observed, pointing at the first establishment, for though its sign was a bit tattered, a bit worn, it seemed promising all the same. Alice laughed and swiftly corrected me.
"A riad. See, there are still some things you don't know about Morocco," she said, her tone light and teasing.
We entered, arms linked, happy to exchange the requested francs for a room key.
"Roommates once more,"
Alice whispered while we waited. "It will be just like Bennington again." I nodded, but did not mention that at Bennington we each had our own bed, while our current accommodation contained only one. The knowledge that we would soon share such a small space together, the possibility of this closeness made my skin hum, as if every nerve was alive with anticipation, with the promise of what that day might make possible.
"Tea,"
Alice quipped over my shoulder as I paid, lest I forget to make the request.
"Yes, tea, please,"
I echoed. The man behind the desk looked momentarily confused.
"Tea?"
I tried again. His face lightened.
"Ah, bien, thé allemand."
We both suppressed a smile. "Oui, merci." With our tea, we ordered a couscous and tagine, although in the end we did not manage to finish either. Our stomachs unused to the heaviness of the dishes. Still, the act of eating, of gorging, seemed somehow necessary. A release for everything that we had seemed to hold in and away from each other. Sitting on the floor of our rented room, we pushed aside the utensils, attacking the dishes the way the locals did with our hands. The juices dripped down our fingers, but we didn't bother wiping them away. Instead, we licked at them, delighting in the foreignness. A piece of what we suspected was lamb. An apricot? A raisin? Not typical fruits we associated with savory meals, but there in the fading light of Morocco, they made a perfect kind of sense. Grease shimmered on our lips by the time we finished, both of us leaning back with a slight laugh of embarrassment as we observed the other.
"We look absolutely frightful,"
Alice declared, but laughing as she did so. I looked at her once. White dress now covered with blotches, dirt from our travels, stains from our meal. I wasn't much better, I suspected. For although my own capris and blouse stood in stark contrast to Alice's white dress, they were of a similarly light hue, and had also suffered from our hasty meal. No point in saving these, I suppose. I grasped the collar of my shirt, pulling so that I could fully inspect the damage. "Of course we save them," Alice exclaimed. "They're souvenirs now, a remembrance of our trip." I looked at her, smiling and unencumbered, her face smeared with grease, her dress askew. Part of me wanted to seize her then, to grasp her fragile shoulders and demand to know why. Why had she locked herself away with a man who was so obviously unworthy of her love? But that meant mentioning him and his unfaithfulness, and I couldn't. Not in that moment. It was not a day for John. Not a day for Tangier. We had shed our layers at last, and Alice had returned. Old, original, ancient Alice, whom I had fallen in love with. I was not ready to see her buried once more, weighted down by both the present and the future. Not yet. "Oh, but I can't wear this back to Tangier," she said, looking down at herself, taking in the full measure of her clothing and the mess she had made. "I didn't pack a second dress, Lucy," she said, looking up at me. "Only night clothes. I suppose that was rather silly, but I guess I was caught up in it all." I could see the frown beginning to form. "Don't worry," I said, anxious to dispel the oncoming storm. "I brought an extra blouse and trousers. You can wear those." She wrinkled her nose while still managing to look pleased at the same time. "Do you think so, Lucy? Trousers?" She leaned forward as if to inspect the ones I was currently wearing. "I've never worn trousers before. Here," I said, reaching for my rucksack, a recent purchase from the Sooks. I could still smell the newness of it, the leather a mixture of something dark and earthy. Manure, perhaps. Most of the tourists wrinkled their noses at the scent, but I found comfort in it. There was something familiar, something real, as if the smell itself assured me of its authenticity, that its material and construction were indeed a product of Tangier, of Morocco, and not some sanitized recreation that had been shipped overseas and marked up in price, specifically for the tourists who wanted that version of Morocco. I retrieved the two garments, already wrinkled from our journey, I noted with some dismay, and handed them to her. "Try them on."
"What, now?"
"Yes, now." She looked down.
"But I'm a mess. I haven't even had a bath yet."
"It doesn't matter, just do it quickly to see how they look." I could see the idea pleased her, and so I pressed until she relented, smiling at her retreating figure as she ran to the bathroom to make the change. The door stood slightly ajar, and I watched as she removed her dress, letting it fall unceremoniously to the floor, the fabric pooling out around her feet. She kicked it aside. I noticed then that she no longer wore the girdle she had in college, so that though her figure was still slender, it was no longer bound and constricted by that stiff garment she had once insisted on wearing. Instead, she stood on only a bra and underwear, a simple garter belt holding up her stockings. Its absence made her look older, not in a regrettable way that made me long for the past, but one that put our years of living together in perspective. I was suddenly aware of just how much time had passed since that first day I had seen her, and all the things that had fallen between us since then.
"Well, what do you think?"
She stood before me, wearing my white linen blouse and tan trousers. I had never before seen her outside of her youthful dresses, her childish frills. I had long come to regard them as an extension of herself, so that when I conjured up an image of Alice, the two were inexorably linked. Stripped of such adornments, even her makeup and hair a pared-down version of the usual, she looked entirely different, so that I felt, oddly, that I did not know her at all. The change left me momentarily speechless. At my silence, her face collapsed in fear. "Is it that bad?" she asked. "No," I said, trying to reassure her. "No, you look wonderful. I almost suspect that if I passed you on the streets, I wouldn't recognize you," I said, meaning it. Alice smiled and did a little movement like a curtsy before disappearing back into the bathroom. I heard the start of the bath, the water pounding against the bottom of its enameled surface. She appeared in the doorway, still dressed, though the top button of the blouse was undone. "This is exactly what I needed, Lucy." She closed the distance between us swiftly, reaching across and grabbing my hand. "Thank you." I smiled. I could still feel her hand's warmth, even after she removed it. I did not sleep that night. Instead, I remained awake long past the hour when the sun had set and the sky had begun to darken. Without warning, rain started to fall against the sloped roof of our riad. I had first heard it as I lay in bed, watching as Alice frowned and sputtered in her sleep, murmuring words I could not decipher. Minutes had gone by, maybe hours. Eventually, I rose, winding my thin dressing gown around me and exiting our room, slowly and quietly, so as not to wake her. I turned my face upward, watching as the rain fell on the glass, sputtering, and then began to slide down away from our building. In the common room, the temperature had shifted. I passed the tables where tomorrow our breakfast would be served, fresh cheese, olives, and bread, a bit of oil or butter if we were lucky. I walked without purpose, without aim, past the floor cushions that served as sofas, the decorative coverings hiding the dilapidated state of the frame. I noticed a forgotten pack of cigarettes, nearly full, sitting on the table. And although I already had some in my handbag, I reached for them. Extracting one and placing it in my mouth, I palmed the rest of the packet, tucking it into the pocket on my nightdress. The cigarette was harsh, and it burned my throat. I tried to remember the last time I had had one of this poor quality. Senior year, I recalled, when Alice and I had snuck into the dance studio one night. Of course it wasn't really sneaking in, since none of the buildings were ever locked. I had always thought that Bennington inspired a peculiar brand of rebellion in its students, particularly when the idea of breaking into a school rather than out was our definition of amusement. "Martha Graham used to teach here, you know," Alice had said as we made our way into one of the dance studios. The floors, even in the dark, had shined with a fresh coating of wax. Three sides of the room were covered in mirrors, while the fourth was glass, looking out across the campus, although the view was blanketed in darkness. There I could see our reflections, thin, long hair, one a bit taller than the other. There was nothing remarkable about either of us, not at first glance. But I had thought then, staring at our reflections, that we could have passed for sisters. There was something so similar in the way that we held ourselves, in the way that we moved, one motion made in reaction to another. "Did you hear what I said before?" Alice had moved over to the mirrors, where a long, sturdy-looking rope hung from the ceiling. She was holding it between her hands. "About Martha Graham?" "Yes," I replied, smiling. I didn't know who Martha Graham was, but I didn't say so, eager to have the night go well. Things had been strange between us, with Alice spending most of her time with Tom, or tucked away in the dark room on her own. Paris and all the plans we had once made seemed far away, promises made by two girls I could no longer remember. She motioned me over to where she stood. "Here," she said, thrusting the rope between my hands. I stared at it doubtfully. What am I supposed to do? Swing? I continued to look at her in confusion until she sighed and took the rope back from me. "Watch," she instructed. Alice pulled the rope to the far corner of the room. Stepping onto the thick knot at the bottom of the rope with one foot, she folded her body so that her arms and one leg wound themselves around the roping. She jumped, pushing her leg back and up, the force propelling her forward. The rope swung across the space of the room, and I stepped back to watch. Alice's hair flung first forward and then back so that her face was obscured, her laughter echoing throughout the small room as she swung back and forth, a human pendulum. A clap of thunder sounded overhead, and I was brought back to Chef Shawin. I turned toward the window, although all I could see was blackness and my own lonely reflection. I continued to stare, realizing how much had changed between my memory of that dance studio and Chef Shawin. It was not just Alice who had altered. Without her, my own sense of self had wavered. I had tried, in the days after the accident, to accept that I would never see her again, that whatever had existed between Alice and myself had been ravaged, had been burned up inside that raging inferno until there was nothing left but cinder, the remains of something that once was. And I felt it, this loss, a physical pain, a knot in my stomach that churned acidic and angry. There had been moments in New York when I had wandered the streets, unable to sleep, unable to stop thinking of her. I had walked until my feet cracked and bled, and then walked farther still, unable to stop. I had been lost, adrift. There was that same swooshing noise in my ear, as normal to me now as it had once been strange. Carefully, I examined it. There was still no pain. No sign of infection, just that unusual feeling of fullness. But then there was something. I looked at my finger, now covered with grit. It didn't matter how much I had washed in the bath. Tangier refused to let me go. But where only a few days before I would have relished this notion, I thought of it now with something like panic. Morocco was becoming too dangerous, not just for the expats who remained, but also for Alice, the city threatening to hold her captive. Both of us needed to get back to our original selves, I realized, and not just for 24 hours. I sat in one of the chairs by the window, though the view outside was obscured in the darkness. Alice would have to know. There could be no more stalling, no more waiting. I would have to tell her about what I had seen, about the fast-ticking clock that was sounding behind us everywhere we went. I knew that John would not wait forever. Tick-tock, tick-tock. And then Alice was standing behind me, as if she had simply materialized, as if a part of my brain had somehow managed to conjure her. I looked at our reflections in the glass, but we no longer looked like sisters. I wasn't sure exactly what had changed. It was true that we had different hairstyles now. Mine was still long and old-fashioned, where Alice had cut hers into something that resembled a bob. I wondered if she had done it before or after her move to Tangier, if it had been in response to the heat or in anticipation of it. There was something else, too, something in the way our expressions settled upon our respective faces. They were no longer interchangeable. Gone were the shared gestures, the intertextuality that had once existed between us. We were simply two women, close once, but different, no longer the same at all. "We need to leave, Alice." The words came out hoarsely, as if they had caught in my throat. A slow, sleepy grin settled on her face. "I know, although part of me wishes that we could stay longer, forever even." She thought we were speaking of Chef Shawin. "No, Alice," I said with a slight shake of my head. "I mean we need to leave Tangier." suddenly awake. Her body tensed. She took a step backward, away from me. You can't stay here anymore. It's not safe. I continued. No? No. I cleared my throat. John knows that I know about Sabine. She looked at me then, confusion crowding her features, but something else was there as well, a peculiar